Appeals. When you begin your arguments, would you please state your name for the record? These arguments are being recorded. And I see Mr. Nyvold, but I am not seeing someone to represent the state.
This is Karen McGillick. I am here.
Oh, there you are. I see you now.
Hi.
Okay. Then, Mr. Nyvold, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor. Okay. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mark Nyvold, representing Mr. Sorensen, the appellant. I have three issues. I'd like to be able to touch on all of them, so I'll try to move quickly enough through all of them, but obviously the point here is to answer questions, so I want to do that as well. The first issue is the sufficiency of the evidence of intent to kill. And there's an analysis, and I go through it in my brief, about, you know, circumstances, the facts proven that had to be proven to find guilt and the inferences that can be drawn from them. And I'm going to discuss that. But I'd like to point out here that this analysis also has to take into account rationality and fairness and common sense. And, you know, in this case, the jury really didn't have any basis to find that a knife had ever been used. Mr. Beck, at the hospital, he doesn't tell the police that a knife was used. He doesn't tell either of the doctors who examined him a knife was used. The doctors say they looked at the front of his neck where this cut or mark showed up a day or two later after he left the hospital. They didn't see anything. They said they looked at the front of the neck. Or Dr. Witt said she looked at it, and so did Dr. Perella. So this mark, which is supposedly indicative of being slashed or slit with a knife, just disappears after he leaves the hospital.
And was there, counsel, if I may interrupt and remind me of the facts of it, was there a screenshot though that showed the mark from body cam actually that night or not?
Well, there was a body cam that night, but the photo is not of the front of the neck. The body cam is taken from the rear. It's a screenshot of a body cam, and it's Exhibit 94. And if you look at that, it's from the back. So it shows the cut at the base of the back of the neck, and then it shows some, apparently, a line of blood flowing down the side of the neck. It is not the front of the neck by any stretch of the imagination.
So remind me of where the picture is from and when it occurred that shows the front of the neck.
Okay, that's a photo that Mr. Beck took of himself after he left the hospital, Exhibits 6B and 6C. And
when's the testimony, when were those photos taken? What did the testimony say about that?
After he left the hospital. It was a day
that
or
same
two
night?
After. Pardon?
I'm sorry, but when after the hospital, that night, or you're saying 2 days later?
It's not clear.
Beck
testified, after I left the hospital, I was shaving, and I noticed this mark on my neck. And then he calls Detective Tinsley, and he says, Beck says, I've got some photos. Tinsley says, send them. Those are the photos that show the mark, and they were not taken in the hospital. They were taken by Mr. Beck without anybody corroborating when they were taken, except that it was after he left the hospital.
But Mr. Nyvold, this is Judge Riley. What are we to do with Sorensen's statement to Smith in the basement that they could not cut Beck loose because he'd go to the police, and the statements made in the Trailblazer that the group needed to finish Beck off and make him disappear?
Okay, well, I would like very much to address that, because the fact on these circumstances, those are also consistent with the inference that they were just trying to scare or frighten him. It's not a one way or the only inference that can be drawn is not that they intended to kill. I mean, obviously, people could be mad and say, well, we want to put this, scare him, you know, make him feel like he'll be killed. It's also consistent with that. Cut or mark on his neck wasn't seen at the hospital. So that's a reasonable inference that can be drawn from this proven circumstance of a late developing or suddenly appearing mark on his neck after he leaves the hospital. That's totally a circumstance that's permitted by the proven facts. And okay, and I've already talked about the Exhibit 94 photo, which does not show, which is taken at the hospital, but does not show anything on the front of the neck. The doctor's testimony that they didn't see anything.
Counsel, what about, I think the bigger concern is leaving the victim by the side of the road after stomping on his head, and then he's playing dead, so it appeared that he was, and they end the statement, of course, said, you know, holy cow, it looked like we've done it. Why is there a reasonable inference that there was intent only to scare in those circumstances?
Well, that statement, they utter an expletive and then say, we did it. That's it admits of more than one interpretation or one inference as well. You know, no one ever made any effort to determine if Mr. Beck was dead. So if they wanted to just knock him out and leave him in a place where he wouldn't be able to say, okay, I know where they went or whatever, that could be encompassed in the statement, we did it. Okay?
But Mr. Nival, this is Judge Flory. Don't we have to look at the totality of the circumstances in determining whether or not that's really a reasonable inference from what occurred here, or what the jury found occurred here,
rather than take
these individual parts of it? It seems to me the law requires us to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine what's reasonable.
Well, and that's what I agree that that's what the jury had to do, and that's what the court has to do. But if you look at the totality, and I've just been talking about them. This is a fellow, Mr. Beck, who claims that a mark on his neck, which is apparently indicative of being slit, as he claims, his neck being slit, that doesn't show up at the hospital. It shows up later. And he never tells the police at the hospital or the doctors that a knife was used. Even when he later says, okay, here's this mark on my knife or my neck, he never describes to Tinsley, Sergeant Tinsley, the object used. He can't say what it was. He doesn't know. So there are all kinds of circumstances here that are facts that are proven that admit of multiple inferences. And that's the point. There are multiple inferences that can be drawn from the totality of the circumstances. And a number of them are inconsistent with an intent to kill. And if there's just one inconsistent inference, that raises a reasonable doubt. And it's inconceivable that if he had been cut and he can't even say what the object was, this slight mark, even if it's a slow developing, it's hard to imagine how it could just suddenly appear and never have been noticed at the hospital where the doctors looked at it. But that's consistent with an object like a ring or a set of keys being used, and even Beck admits that. So if there was no knife used, that seriously undercuts the logic and the basis for finding that there was an intent to kill. You know, if an object that couldn't inflict a life-threatening wound was used, that's indicative of no intent to kill. That's an inference that's conceivable or possible. And the state's evidence can't exclude that. Beck himself can't exclude that. He admits that he didn't know what was used. Ring, a set of keys, a lighter. He's admitting that any of those could be used. So it's certainly a legitimate inference that nothing that could have killed him was used.
Oh, go ahead, Judge.
We seem to be ignoring the fact that there's evidence that the jury heard that his head was stomped after he was thrown out of a moving vehicle to the point of apparent unconsciousness. I'm not quite certain why we're spending so much time on this knife issue when it seems to me that alone would be a reasonable inference of an intent to kill.
Well, he wasn't unconscious. He feigned that. So it wasn't as if he had been kicked or to the extent that he had been made unconscious and somehow indicating that there was an intent to kill him by kicking him. He feigned that.
But the people in the car didn't know that.
Well, but they didn't make any effort to find out, well, is this man really dead? They didn't do that. If they really wanted to make sure he was dead as a result of being kicked, they would have tried to, you know, take a pulse, see if he's breathing. They didn't do that.
But that would be murder, not attempted murder, which is what he was convicted of.
Well, but attempted murder requires the intent to kill, and that's what's at issue here. Was there sufficient evidence of that, and are there inferences that can be drawn from the proven facts inconsistent with an intent to kill? And there are. They didn't know. It's far from certain that they had an intent to kill where they don't even try to make sure he's dead. But let me move on to my next issue, please. The next one matter is whether there was more than one behavioral incident here. The court and probation agreed that the kidnapping and the murder were one behavioral incident, but the judge found that he didn't actually make a finding. He just gave him a point pursuant to probation's recommendation for the assault, and that implicitly means it was a different, separate behavioral incident. But it clearly was not under the case law. The state argued that the reason Mr. Beck tried to kill, the reason Mr. Sorensen tried to kill Mr. Beck was because to cover up the assault. They argued that to the jury. The state recognized that the effort to avoid responsibility for the assault, what was motivated, everything that came after that, the kidnapping and the attempted murder. On the state's own argument, they should concede this. But the
counsel, may I ask? So relative to the avoidance of apprehension and then the motive, argument that was made, do you agree, though, that the crimes that need to be substantially contemporaneous? And if not, for example, could an attempted murder the next day, if they decide, I really think he's going to go to the police, so an attempted murder to avoid apprehension? I mean, you would agree that that would not be the same behavioral incident, would you not? How does time fit into this?
If it were 24 hours and then they decide to go back and get him?
Yes.
Probably not, but that's not what we have here. There was no break. They didn't leave and come back. This was the assault ends. They say, Sorensen says, well, what do you want to do with him? And, or Smith says, I'm, going to cut him loose. And Sorensen says, you can't do that. You'll go to the police. And then he's put in the car and driven off. That's a continuous series of events that make the kidnapping and the attempted murder substantially contemporaneous. I mean, there's no way around that. There's no way you can say that this was not substantially contemporaneous.
How do we distinguish the Bookwalter case then? The defendant didn't leave and come back in that case either, and it happened under a much shorter period of time, yet the Supreme Court found that those were not the same behavioral incident.
Well, there's several reasons why they found that there was multiple behavioral incidents there. First of all, they found that it wasn't substantially contemporaneous because had the criminal sexual conduct, and they found that at that time he hadn't formed any intent to kill. Okay, but here the state's argument was he realizes as soon as the assault ends that Beck has to be finished off. So, and there's no gap in time. I mean, it takes time to drive away, but this was not this is not like Bookwalter, in Bookwalter, they also said he had numerous opportunities to make a safe escape. Here, that's not correct, because Beck testified that Sorensen and Smith made statements that would enable him to Beck to identify Sorensen. So there wasn't an, I mean, they realized that this guy knows who we are, or he's going to be able to identify me because I'm the father. He tells him, I'm doing this because of what you did to my son. And Smith says to Beck, this is my baby's daddy. So if Beck leaves, he tells the police that, they find Sorensen in short order. So he knows that this, you know, he's got to be taken out of there now. And there's no, except for the time it takes to drive 12 miles, there's no break in any of this. And again, the intent to do this kidnapping and attempted murder by the state's own argument is formed at Smith's house as soon as the assault ends. That's not the circumstances in Bookwalter. They specifically said Bookwalter did not have any intent to kill at the time of the sexual assault. And that prevented it from being substantially contemporaneous.
Mr. Nyvold, your 15 minutes are up. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Respondent, are you ready to begin?
I am. Thank you very much. My name is Karen McGillick. I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. And may it please the court and opposing counsel, I would like to address both the sufficiency of the evidence argument and, if there's time, the separate behavioral incident argument. To begin with, we have very strong evidence in this case, stronger than a typical case of intent. There's no question that, you know, it is oftentimes difficult to understand what a defendant's intent is, but in this case, we have very clear statements that the defendant made about his desire to ensure that this victim not survive this incident. We have him saying, much like the case in State v. Horst, that he wanted to both that they were not able to, quote, cut him loose, and that they needed to finish him off and make him disappear. This is very strong evidence that he knew that his accomplices, or he even himself, wanted to kill the victim and intended his presence or actions to further the commission of that crime. We are looking, assuming we are under, if you know, the direct evidence of those statements alone are not sufficient, and if we are to get into a circumstantial evidence standard of review, we are able to look at a lot of the facts of this case to help with inferring what his intent was. And that includes looking at things like the events that occurred before and after the crime, his conducts and statements that occurred, his conduct and the nature and extent of the victim's wounds and the failure to aid the victim after the assault. And we look at also the close association when we're looking at accomplice liability of the defendant's association with the other co-defendants or accomplices that were involved in the case. Now, certainly this evidence that while in the ditch, the defendant in this case, Sorensen, pulled back the victim's head and attempted to slit his throat, we have the victim's testimony about that. Now, you have to take that testimony in account, the fact that this victim had been through an incredibly traumatic ordeal that had gone on for many hours in multiple locations. We know that Sorensen arrived on the scene around 6:45 p.m. and that he fled the scene of the Becks Road area around 9 p.m. But at that point, even at that long span of time, the victim had already undergone a previous assault and kidnapping in the basement of Smith's house that had occurred much earlier in the day. So this had been going on a long time. He had been severely beaten and injured at this point. So the fact that he is not able to identify the precise weapon that was used, or that he may have had what many victims have after a long traumatic event, the inability to accurately recount all details in his very first statement, that certain details were forthcoming over time, that's a very common victim response to trauma. And what we do have is his very clear statement at trial that is what occurred, that he pulled his head back, he attempted to slit his throat. The fact that we don't have the additional evidence of the specific knife that was used, or that he can't identify that it was a knife, that is really not dispositive whatsoever. Frankly, though, when looking at the totality of the circumstances, the use of the attempt to slit his throat is just one piece of evidence that shows that there was an intent to kill. Beyond that, we have the defendant's words and the sort of plot that was ongoing as they were driving out to the wilderness. But we have very strong evidence that there were other attempts to kill here. And namely, the attempt to kill was the fact that this victim was beaten so badly before he was driven out to the woods that it was a cold night. There was snow on the ground. It was freezing conditions. He didn't have shoes on. He didn't have a coat on. He wasn't dressed properly. I think his pants were pulled down. We have him being stomped on in the ditch additional times. So he's already been injured at the house, and now he's being stomped on in the ditch, including direct stomps to his head. And I think earlier in the victim's testimony, he had discussed that the defendants were wearing like steel-toed boots. So we're talking about stomps to his directly to his head. Now that those stomps occurred both before and after this attempt to slit his throat. And what we know is that the testimony is that Mock, the co-defendant or the accomplice, had sort of delivered this final blow after the attempt to slit his throat. And that was when the victims decided to play dead. And that is when the defendants at that point thought, oh my God, we killed him. We have to get out of here. So they then leave the scene without rendering any aid, without any means of assistance. He's 12 miles from Duluth. He's somewhere he doesn't know how to find his way back, or there's no reason for the defendants to suspect that he's going to be able to regain consciousness. He's still hogtied at this point with rope. So they leave him there tied, hands down, no coat, inability to do anything. All of these factors taken together support this inference of this intent to kill. And not only that, certainly support the jury's determination that the defendant in this case, Sorensen, was an accomplice and therefore guilty of aiding and abetting attempted felony murder in this case.
I would like you to address Mr. Nyvold's third argument, which is that his attorney conceded his guilt as to third-degree assault. And I am not convinced by your brief that Mr. Sorensen acquiesced in that, because unlike the cases that you cite, his attorney wasn't saying anything until the closing argument about that.
Well, I think there's certainly no direct evidence on the record of the defendant acquiescing to that strategy, but there was certainly evidence that there had been discussions off the record between counsel and the defendant, and that they came back and they had said on the record that they had discussed their strategy and how they were going to handle it and how that had occurred off the record. And so I think we can look at those statements to indicate that certainly something was discussed among the attorney and the client about that strategy. But not only that, that sort of had been the defense's theme from the beginning of the trial on, that they had, you know, had this strategy from the beginning to try to, you know, there's such strong evidence in this case of the defendant's involvement in the assault that I think a good attorney understands that we have to do something with that, and that it's more important to attempt to get the defendant acquitted of the attempted murder charge, which is the far more serious event, and the kidnapping charges, the aiding and abetting there. And if that strategy means we concede the guilt on the thing that there's really no way to rebut, we can go forward with that strategy. And that sort of was the strategy throughout the trial, to try to play up the fact that, you know, through cross-examination and through other things, we can see that that was the strategy of the defense all the way along. So by the time it comes to closing argument and it's sort of expressly stated for the first time, I think the record lends us to understand that that wasn't necessarily the first time that it was ever said. It was just more explicitly stated in closing and perhaps had been more implicitly or suggested earlier on in the defense's strategy, the way they cross-examined the witnesses and whatnot. And so I think when we're able here, you know, the Supreme Court has still recognized acquiescence to have occurred in situations like this, where there's the same strategy from beginning to end of the trial and there's no objection. And certainly the defendant had been sitting through the trial, had heard the cross-examinations, had, you know, no reason to object on the record prior to that. And certainly, you know, it's an understandable trial strategy to try to, you know, give the jury, this is such a horrific crime for this jury to hear, that in order to try to give the jury this out, so to speak, that you can still convict him, you can still hold him accountable for what he's done and what they've proven that he's done, but let's acquit him of these more serious charges, I think is a very understandable trial strategy under these circumstances.
Could you give counsel a little bit more detail of why you seem to be relying, I think, on the cross-examination? Could you draw that out for me? Why is the cross-examination, why would that lead to a suggestion? Give me like specific examples of why the cross-examination would demonstrate the defendant's agreement to a concession.
You know, there was never a challenge during cross-examination, for example, to the identity of the defendant being the person who struck him. When cross-examining the victim, for example, the defense essentially conceded that that was the case, and then very quickly moved on to kind of attacking the victim's perception of, for example, the knife, or attacking the victim's recollection of the events regarding the attempt to kill, to say, well, you didn't report at the hospital and that was never said, and you know, you waited until March 5th to report to the police officer that you noticed this mark. And during cross-examination of the police witnesses, the focus again was on attacking only that portion, the attempted murder, of whether or not they had established that there had been this knife involved, or whether or not they had met the burden of proof on those elements, but almost exclusively focused on that. The defense never made an attempt during cross-examination really of the law enforcement witnesses, or particularly the victim himself, to challenge the fact that the defendant had been the person who had come to the house, that he was involved in the assault in the downstairs bedroom, that he had been in the car. And so, you know, you can really see that throughout the trial, there was no opening statement either. And so, you know, we're kind of relying on looking at how they chose to cross-examine these witnesses. It was clear, I think, from the cross-examination that the defense was never really disputing the assault. Does that answer your question? It's as best I can without...
Yep, no, that's helpful.
Okay.
Could I ask you please to address why the trying to avoid apprehension does not make this a single behavioral incident?
Absolutely. Let me just try to get to that spot in my notes here.
I mean, I think especially because the idea of that we can't let him go was quite close in time, it sounds like, to the assault itself.
Right. You know, certainly when there is, you know, a substantially contemporaneous motive to try to commit two crimes at the same time, you know, if one of those is to try to avoid apprehension, that would be a reason to impose that doctrine. But the Supreme Court in Bookwalter made clear that, for example, that case where it was much tighter time period, where there was a very similar thing here. He had raped this victim. I'm certain there was the same sort of concern about whether or not he would be caught if she testified against him. I think that's a pretty common theme in a case where a crime might eventually turn into murder. But it was really in Bookwalter considered more of an afterthought. It wasn't considered to be this sort of premeditated plan that was all occurring at the same time. And in this case, we have a highly volatile, highly emotional situation where the defendant's son has purportedly, or at least allegedly, been sexually abused by the victim in this case. He shows up at the house, you know, things happen, he's upset, he's angry, you know, the assault occurs, and this decision to eventually move him and attempt to murder him was really an afterthought in the same way that it was an afterthought in Bookwalter. So the fact that some part of that may have included this idea of wanting him to not be able to go to jail for it, or he didn't want the defendant to be able to testify against him, is really the same type of afterthought that occurred in Bookwalter as in this case.
Wasn't it similarly an afterthought though in the Hawkins case? I mean, when they decided, and that was a case, right, where decide when it was a undercover police officer or an informant or something, right? And once that was discovered, they needed to kill that person, but that was initially not going to be that. I'm trying to figure out why this afterthought, like whether when you're committing the first crime, whether you already have to have in mind that you intended to commit another crime to avoid apprehension. That doesn't seem to be clear in the case law. It seems like you can decide to do that after the fact, after you've committed the first crime. And my question is how do we decide, you know, does that decision have to be far away from the initial crime, or can it immediately follow, but the actual act itself to avoid apprehension is a couple hours later, as argued? I'm not exactly sure how the factors fit together in the various cases.
I apologize, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You know, I think that the case law isn't exactly clear on that note, but in State v. Stevenson, the court had talked about the fact that even if the second offense had been committed for the purpose of avoiding apprehension, they would still go through this, you know, single behavioral incident analysis to consider whether it occurred substantially contemporaneously. And as we argued, you know, in our brief, for all the same reasons, there are multiple reasons, like in the cases that were cited, Bookwalter and Munt, and I'm going to say it wrong, but Krampotich, that there are reasons that these three incidents can be, I mean, they were occurring over the course of a long, drawn-out thing. So even though the date is the same, we have different time periods, we have different locations, we have different criminal objectives occurring. And so when you break down that separation that occurs between these three behavioral incidents, it cannot be said that the desire to avoid apprehension occurred at, you know, substantially contemporaneously with the other crimes. This was evolving, and the assault and the kidnapping had occurred, and then it came to an end, and then there was a decision made at that point to move him and attempt to kill him, but that did not occur contemporaneously with the previous two offenses. And so while there may have been some desire to avoid apprehension, as often it may occur when somebody decides to murder a victim that they wronged, it didn't occur in the type of contemporaneous way that it did in Hawkins, which was the sort of immediate reaction to discovering this officer. And, you know, at Hawkins, they also looked at the fact that there was no way to make a safe escape, whereas in this case, there was multiple opportunities for this defendant to walk away from the situation at all three stages of the crimes. So because he chose not to do that, but yet had the opportunity to make a safe escape, that also cuts against his argument that they occurred substantially contemporaneously. And I see that I'm out of time. I apologize.
Judge Riley? Oh, excuse me, counsel. May I ask one short follow-up or question?
Certainly.
Counsel, in looking at, I know there are arguments made about 60904 and multiple convictions. There was no, when we looked at the warrant of commitment, it appears that there was a conviction entered for count four, which is the attempted second degree murder. There was no discussion of that in the briefs. Would you agree that, and maybe that's putting you on the spot, but would you agree that that's a lesser included that should not be in a warrant of commitment?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state would then ask that both his convictions and his sentences be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Nivel, do you have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Thank you. Real quickly on the second degree attempted murder, I don't see that was ever, it was never sentenced. It hasn't been adjudicated.
Well, I think it says convicted on a warrant of commitment. So I think it was adjudicated, perhaps erroneously, in a warrant of commitment. It was not sentenced, you're correct.
Okay. Let me try to address as many of the points as the state raised. This idea that Stevenson, which is cited in Bookwalter, is somehow supports the state's argument. That was two incidents of sexual assault separated by 5 hours. That's not what we have here. You have immediately after the assault ends, then the decision is made to take Mr. Beck, and as the state argued, he had to be taken to be killed and removed. That was what they argued. They recognized that this was an immediate decision.
Does it, counsel, why does it matter, though? Does it matter if the decision is immediate, if in fact the offense that we're looking at, the attempted murder, is a couple hours later under the state's theory? So even if you decided, in other words, do we measure the time between the two offenses or the time between offense number one and the decision to commit offense number two?
Well, I think you have to look at the decision. Obviously, you make a decision, but you may not, for whatever, based on what kind of crime you want to commit, you may not be able to do it immediately. But here the decision was made immediately, which shows that it was substantially contemporaneous. It wasn't as if he came up with the idea to kill him an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later, or the next day. So this is one continuous incident. We've got unity of time, objective, and place is different, but obviously place can change. It doesn't, you know, the fact that it's a different place doesn't mean that it's not one behavioral incident, because the plan might require you to allegedly move the victim. But the Stevenson case doesn't help the state. Concerning the concession argument, the idea that there was this discussion by counsel at the end saying, well, we've talked to Mr. Sorensen about some things. The only things that he said that had been discussed was the right to present a defense and whether or not he would testify. He didn't say anything about, well, we also talked about that I'm going to concede guilt. So that the state is just asking you to guess, or and not even make, it wouldn't even be a good guess to say that, well, that discussion must have covered this this concession issue as well. In fact, the fact that there was this discussion and the concession wasn't said to be part of it actually confirms that it was never discussed. Unless there are other questions, I do have one other point about the concession. You know, the state wants to use the fact that you don't make an opening statement, you don't question some witnesses or question them very long, as a concession that the defendant is supposed to realize from that we're going to concede guilt on a specific offense. You know, that just basically turns every defense premised on let's put the state to its burden. We're not going to do much. We're just going to let them try to prove their case. That turns that into a concession in case the attorney later decides to admit an element of the offense. You know, I cite the Torres case. Silence as to an element of the offense is not conceding it, and it certainly can't. And that can also be extrapolated to the entire offense. You're not, by remaining silent and putting the state to its burden, conceding anything. So it wasn't reasonable to find, it's not reasonable to find that there was acquiescence here. Thank you.
So I just have a quick question, Mr. Nyvold. So then if we agreed with you that there's no implied acquiescence under Pertin, isn't the remedy then a remand for an evidentiary hearing on that issue to find out what in fact was discussed, since there wasn't any private record made on those discussions?
Well, if it's unclear whether the defendant knew what was going on, yes, but it's not unclear. It's clear.
You just told us it was unclear because we'd have to speculate as to what they talked about. So how can we know what they talked about with any clarity on that issue?
Well, it's certainly clear that he didn't acquiesce.
Expressly acquiesce, but there's the issue of implied acquiescence.
Well, but you have to determine that from the record as well. It's not automatic to remand in every case. It's possible to determine that there wasn't any implied acquiescence as well, because, you know, the attorney has to do certain things to make it, he has to, like, argue this, have it pursue a strategy of concession. If he does that, well, yes, then you can infer acquiescence. But there wasn't anything like that. I think the record is clear that he did not acquiesce.
Thank you. Any other questions from either Judge Flory or Judge Smith? I see Judge Smith shaking her head no, and Judge Flory shaking his head no. Thank you for your appearances via WebEx. How was the experience for you, Mr. Nyvold?
I think it went well. I thought everything worked very well, which is the best we can hope for. So.
Thank you, Ms. McGillick. How about you?
I would agree. I had a computer glitch during the test run, and so I was super nervous, to be honest, that would happen again. But Ethernet cable seems to be the key to not having that occur. So
right. Well, thank you all, and the case is now under advisement. We will adjourn and discuss our non-oral cases. Have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bye.